You ready? Am I live? Is my mic on? I can never tell. I talk so loud typically that I can never tell. But let's begin with a moment of silence. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to celebrate this thing called Windows XP. Electric word, Windows XP. Some people thought it'd be around forever, but that's a mighty long time. And it really is the transition away from Windows XP and that mindset of how we handle change that we're here to talk about today. So a little bit before the session started, I talked about how this is not a crazy, demo-heavy, full of console mode debugging kind of sessions. So just to reiterate that, if you came to see the show, those sessions are already over with. We did have them. We had one on Windows security and one on web app compat, and they're recorded. There were no PowerPoints shown at all. The point that we want to talk about here is to take it up a level, to get out of the weeds and really talk about what it means to transition from the way we used to do things and what served us very well in an era where we could take applications, install them once, and let them run for a decade, and everything would be fine. The environment wouldn't change that much. To an era now where it seems like change is happening at an ever-accelerating pace. How do we keep up? What are other customers doing, and what are the principles? Because we get that that's different, and believe me, it's different for us too. One of the big changes, for example, that we've been going through is in the Internet Explorer team, where obviously you probably agree we had a lot of changes we need to make. And we've begun to ship a lot more quickly, and not ship in the context of here's another browser with a bunch of marketing, right, where most of the active shipping was us telling you how great this thing was that you were worried was probably going to break all of your stuff. But instead, to be able to step back and go, what is it that we need to deliver to the market? Things like enterprise mode that didn't wait for an IE12 to come out. We just shipped it. And we followed that up in August with the ability to block certain ActiveX controls, and we'll talk about that. We followed that in October. We just announced last week, we gave you the directions for how to turn it on. The code actually came in October. A site discovery toolkit, a way to gather more information and intelligence about what's running in your environment. And we've begun to ship things. August brought enhancements to the F12 tools. It brought enhancements to WebGL. We're no longer delaying innovation into a big bang that for most IT pros ends up just being a big headache. Now we're starting to more agilely deliver things, and the question then comes, if you're going to be spewing out innovation more quickly, that's good, I like innovation, but what do I need to do to change to make it so that this innovation will come and I'm able to take advantage of it? It's not just things that are happening to me. Because when we think about where Windows has come from and where it's going, this is kind of how we think. It's been a platform that's been incredibly stable. And we have a bunch of subcomponents of that platform as well. Now, I have had people challenge me on this. I was visiting some customers in Japan, and they said to me, "You are not stable." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" The average age of the enterprise application on the Microsoft platform is 12 years. That's a pretty good measure of durability. And they said, "Nope. That is not a good measure." I said, "Well, what is good?" He said, "The mainframe. I have things that are 40 years old on the mainframe. That's good. You should do that." Now, we're not aspirational to get that far, but we certainly understand that you don't want to be on an upgrade treadmill, constantly investing more energy, more time, more money, creating the exact same functionality. If upgrades are doing that, we need to fix that problem. If, however, upgrades are enabling you to take more advantage of the platform so that the innovation does you some good and is worth the effort, then that's the place we want to be. Because there are a number of things I think we've done really well. One platform that we absolutely recognize has been huge for the enterprise is VB6. By the time VB6 falls out of support, It will be older than Buddy Holly was, an American singer. It'll be older than the Betamax. It'll have lived longer than Windows XP. It'll have a warranty longer than your average Hyundai or BMW. It will have been around for north of 26 years as an application platform. And here's a rather staggering fact. Approximately 50% of all application code running in the enterprise is still running on VB6. Half. So it was a very stable platform, right? And that's always the tension. How do I take this concept of durability, so investments give a long bit of payoff, without going so far down the path of expecting things to live infinitely? That's the challenge. How do I not do that? And it almost seems as if the more you go wholeheartedly into one platform, the more you invest in it, the harder it is to peel yourself off of it later. So that's the magic. That's what we're trying to discover. And I don't have all of the answers. I can just tell you what people are doing so far to try and address it. Because we do need to try and figure this out. Because in the end, stability and agility don't have to be the opposite of one another. I don't have to keep everything the same in order to keep my enterprise, my organization running. And that requires us to make some changes. The historical way that we would manage any kind of migration project, you're going to Windows 7, to Windows 8, to IE8, to IE11, to any platform, this literally, those words come directly off the App Compat toolkit. Number one, collect, go figure out what you have. First of all, tell me that's not remarkable. You're running your business on stuff that you don't know exists. And yet, all enterprise migration projects start with it. I don't know what these people are running. Well, think about it. Is anyone here working in insurance? It's okay. No, I'm not going to pick on the insurance industry. I'm going to make an analogy, which is you're, as an IT organization, providing an insurance policy for applications. But instead of making people apply and prove that they are insurable, it would be like me going and buying a house. The house is made of straw. It quickly burns down because maybe I'm a heavy smoker. I'm constantly throwing, and it's boom, it burns down. And then I call up your insurance company and I say, sir, you have to buy me a new house. And he's going to respond quite rightly, I don't know who you are. You never asked for a policy. You never told me about your house. And you passed no quality checks for me to determine whether or not you're insurable. But that's exactly what happens when we start with, hey, go collect, find it all, and figure out what matters. That's us saying, well, who did we provide an insurance policy for? Let's go find out. If we can find it, we'll insure it. So your responsibility, therefore, is go find every house that everyone owns and send them a bill for their policies. What a strange way to start. And this process doesn't work. The notion of find it all and then analyze it all, figure out what works, doesn't make mathematical sense at all. All right, and we talked about this. I conveniently logged off. So let me unlock my machine, and I'm going to use my favorite demo tool, the calculator. Because this is a bit of math people tend to do. I did this for the web, and I'll just go ahead and pick that example again. The average organization, the average one, if I measure over a period of a few months, the unique URL, that is not outputting, is it? I went the wrong way. There we go. That's a lot better than the black screen, huh? The average organization, measuring the unique URLs that get put out, and we've seen this from gathering from proxy logs and really seeing what URLs are being requested, hits on the average of 500 million URLs over a fairly long period of time. And if I start with this tactic of, well, go find it all, so I got 500 million, now analyze it. So I'm going to take the task of analyzing, and I'm going to spend 5 minutes looking at each of those URLs just to see, you know, all right, how much time am I going to have to invest to find any information? So 5 minutes, which ends up being this many hours. And someone's going to charge me an hourly rate to do that. So let's say they're going to charge me 50 euros an hour. So I'm only going to need a small budget of $2.08 billion to do that analysis. Should be easy to get that. I still haven't fixed anything, mind you. This is just discovery. And I'm $2.08 billion into it. We can't sustain that. No one can afford it. And this is the challenge of, if I just insure everything that you manage to get put up there, there's no way I can handle it. And so the process that we're seeing people migrate to is one that says, I am not going to be on the hook for everything. I'll help you, and I have some tools that might help you, but I'm not going to make myself ultimately responsible for detecting every little bit of code you happen to run and giving it all the same exact insurance policy. And there's a saying that gets used a lot in security circles, but it also works in compatibility circles and anywhere you're investing against things. And that is, if you invest as much protecting your diamonds as you do protecting your paperclips, you'll end up with a lot fewer diamonds and a lot more paperclips. Because think about what that would mean. I'm going to invest the same amount of money ensuring that something that someone uses once a month just to help them plan their travels works at the same rate that I'm going to invest in ensuring that what we use to track and bill our customers for our efforts. That's crazy. And it's kind of where people start. So how do we manage, right? Understand what it is that we're on the hook for and start to build in criteria for understanding whether it aligns to our organizational goals. It seems in a lot of the groups that I talk to that the rules for getting software deployed within the organization walls and the organizational boundaries are as follows. Did it compile? Yes. Ship it. It works on my machine is another real common certification level that we see in terms of what kind of quality bars we put in place. Now, as folks who, how many of you are developers who write the apps that go into an organization? So a handful. And how many of you are IT pros who get, you know, sit on the other side of the fence that all the apps are hurled over? So most of the folks in the audience, right? This bridge has got to be crossed a lot better. And I feel like I sit a little bit in the middle of that. I write code, so if all, you know, I guess I, now there's more IT pros than folks like me. So you can gang up on me if you want to, but I write code. That's what I do. That's why I'm good at App Compact, because I know how code works. But this notion of just fling it over, just create it and do it everywhere, shadow IT is growing. IT is getting to the point where they can't wait. There's so many more offerings. It's so easy for partners to put things in the cloud and put up a website that the barrier to new code entering in doesn't matter. So as we start to think about managing, what are the ways that we can go in and reduce the friction of applications being managed? So we understand what are the liabilities that the IT organization takes on versus the developer, and does everyone understand where those boundaries lie? This is the challenge, managing it. And then assessing it. Assessment is one of those challenges that we work on, which is understanding what the impact of that change is going to be. And then updating it. Updating on the assumption that what I have today isn't necessarily what I want in the future. Right? We're going to talk through each of these, but the update, I think, is where it's really starting to resonate with folks is as people get applications that are now running in very different form factors. The ability to run on a phone or on a tablet. Surface Pro 3 is one example where I have a ton of conversations because people fire up their Surface Pro 3. They fire up an application, and actually, I can't project it on the screen because the screen has a much lower resolution than the screen itself. If you want, afterwards, I can show you some old MFC applications that I wrote that on a Surface Pro 3 look like they're about 4 by 3 pixels large, this tiny little thing in the middle that are not in any way friendly to your fingers. That's the challenge of making sure that you understand today's computing environment. So managing them. How do we keep a list of what matters to us, and how do we assess it? And we think about managing. I had a chat after my last session where someone was talking about how their introductory entrance into managing it was when they had to use a pair of crutches. So this customer had applications that they were using enterprise mode for Internet Explorer, to get the application over the wire. They wanted to make sure they could get to IE11 as fast as they can. And incidentally, I agree with that approach. And here's why. If I get everyone on IE11 first, as cheap and fast as I possibly can, then whatever money I have left over, I can use to make really good HTML5 websites. Versus, if someone gives me the mandate, no, everything must be HTML5. Everything or nothing goes. No compat view, no enterprise mode, no crutches, do it all right, quote unquote right. What are you going to get? Because in the interim, during the transition, all of your users were going to start with 8 or 9 or 10 or wherever you are. They won't have 11 yet. So you can't write code that has a hard dependency on IE11 or greater, the most modern browser that we have, or other modern browsers. You'll have to just deliberately choose not to use some features, which means you're settling for a least common denominator site. And it's really bad if you have IE8 as what your starting point, because then you can't do any HTML5 that IE8 didn't do, and IE8 didn't do hardly any HTML5. So you're not getting a true HTML5 website, even though it's running in that document mode. Much better to get a true take advantage of what's there after everybody gets there with the money you have left over. So managing it, keeping this list. One of the things that I see people start with is they think, I'm already doing application management because I have System Center and I see all of the apps that are installed. Does System Center list all of the unique websites that everyone has visited? Does System Center list every single application that someone grabbed from the store if you're running Windows 8? Does System Center list all of the things that people randomly downloaded? If you have local admins, you know, you'll pick up some of them. Does it pick all the per user stuff up? If it doesn't register itself properly in AdRemove programs or the MSI database, does it get picked up? There are some blind spots. It's not perfect. If you don't account for the fact that people could have other things that they call an app, you might miss out. What about Office documents that are apps? I had one organization where about a third of the apps that they had were Microsoft Access. They had no idea, by the way. They were very surprised by the prevalence of Microsoft Access, and even more surprised by the prevalence of Microsoft Access 97. But it's easy to miss things that end up mattering if you don't partner really closely with the business and understand it. Number one, figure out what really matters to you. And in addition to what matters, figure out a life cycle. Because even in the best managed organization, I've worked with one so far, right? And I'll actually give, I don't know if I'm allowed to do this, but I will anyways. We'll see if I get in trouble. But they were doing great stuff. It was Intel. Intel keeps track not only of their apps and when they came into play, they have a retirement date pre-planned for all of them. Only customer I've ever seen that was that evolved in their ability to manage it. They knew when they were going to plan on service packing. They didn't always hit it because, you know, business changes and your forecasts don't always end up being right on, but they at least went out and made a plan. This other customer with the enterprise mode, he said, if I put you on the list, you've got to tell me when you're going to come back off of it, when you're going to fix it. And it could be far out. It doesn't have to be immediate. You just have to have a plan for what you're going to do so it's not 100 million years from now. What's my plan? So don't worry just about desktop apps. Don't think it's already done. And as I talked about before, the concept of web, don't try to find everything. You don't want to inventory. You don't want to see it all. You want to discover what matters, and you want to discover where the risk lies. And from there, to then start building out a taxonomy of how you're going to treat them. And this is important. This is not about casting value judgments. This app is better or more important or anything else. It's all about what are you going to do in terms of your insurance policy. And this taxonomy is one that I've seen used really successfully. Managed. I am going to make sure that I am accountable for understanding the impact of change, whether it's a small change, such as a Windows update, or a large change, such as an OS migration. I'm going to understand it. And I'm going to measure it, and I'm going to track it. I'm not going to spend as much on a low-risk change as a high-risk change. I'm going to be smart, but I'm going to be proactive. Supported, the next tier. If you have a problem and you call me, I'll help you out. But I'm not going to have looked at it beforehand. And it's interesting, right, kind of the dichotomy that we have here just in the first two. At Microsoft, we have very, very different agility requirements. Because we talk about the agility that we have, we can't really say, oh, go ahead, guys, wait for the upgrade, because our people don't wait. In fact, with Windows 8, I have not seen the Windows 10 numbers yet, so I don't know what they are. But when Windows 8 first came out in the first pre-release, the one we shipped first, we were one-third deployed before the end of the first day it was out. And it wasn't even a final shipping operating system yet. So our IT department is not managing against, oh, well, let's go as fast as we can so then they can upgrade. They're managing against, these jerks are going to upgrade no matter what we say. They're not listening to us. So we better be ready. We better know what's going to cause us potential business problems up front and tell you through loud banner ads like, hey, by the way, you won't be able to use this app anymore. In which case, we all just upgrade anyway and use virtual machines to run those apps. But when we consider that, we have to be very parsimonious about what becomes managed and what we look at beforehand. For example, I work in the consulting division of our business, so I work directly with customers. Two systems to kind of give an example of what falls where. Our time reporting system leads to bills being sent to customers. That's managed. We make sure that works. Our expense reporting application leads to money going back to us. That's supported. We don't look at it beforehand. We just say, all right, well, you know what? If you can't get your money back, you call us. We'll fix it then. Until then, we won't look at it. Because those are the business priorities. Bringing in revenue, more important than sending out revenue. No one gets irritated unless it's broken for a really long time and they manage that. Supported means I'm not going to look at it beforehand. Unsupported means you're okay using it. But don't call me if you have a problem. So when I look at unsupported, this is an area that I think has had the largest bit of growth. Because with the advent of Windows 8 and the new app model that we put in there, I had a session on Tuesday that spoke specifically to the Windows 8 security model, because the goal was absolutely to restore your trust and ability to install apps and try them out and see if they work, without risk that your system is going to be compromised by really closely managing that. So there's a lot of things you can go and grab. But the fact that I go and grab an app and install it, and you trust me to do that, and you trust the OS to make sure that that's a safe thing to do, doesn't mean you're going to take my call. If I call you and say, hey, the stock app is broken, Microsoft IT is going to be like, well, call them. I didn't write that, and that's not ours to fix. But carry on running it. Let them know. Unsupported is a growing category. And then there's banned. Those are the apps that we're actively trying to block from running, using things like filtering at the proxy server, using things like AppLocker. These are things we know are bad or harmful to the environment. This taxonomy starts to build out. Well, how are you going to treat them differently? And within the managed category, then start to prioritize them. How important are they to me? Again, to drive behavior. This is not value judgment. This is not about evaluating things, but instead it's about determining what you're going to do. For example, I had one customer that would say, for all of my gold applications, they were a healthcare customer, right? So something going wrong with their most critical applications could lead to someone getting hurt, right? Or someone not getting better, all kinds of other really dramatic things. Those are gold. And they would say, for anything of significant risk, where there's a potential of up to, you know, it was fairly arbitrary, like 5%, right? 5% failure rate of applications would trigger full regression testing for all gold applications. How many deaths? There have thus far been zero deaths due to app compat that I'm aware of. But to your point, right, it's theoretically possible. You got something that makes sure the heart monitor stays on and it stops reporting. That's a problem. One of the app compat wasn't in healthcare, but one of the app compat issues that I had to deal with was this is a 32/64-bit compatibility. It was an application that was instrumenting an oil drill, and it was leveraging Token Ring. Anyone been around long enough to remember Token Ring networks? It's okay, so y'all old like me, right? So we got some gray hairs. Token Ring, and the reason why they use Token Ring is because Token Ring has a heartbeat. Ethernet doesn't. And so they judge a lack of a heartbeat meant failure, right? And they would shut everything down. Or clearly signal of failure also meant failure, and they would shut everything down. But the overall goal was this thing is spinning at a very high rate, very high temperature, drilling through rocks. So if water stops spraying, everything shuts down, or the thing blows up and people die. There are no token ring adapters that we know of still for 64-bit because no one else has a use case for token ring. So they have to use an old token ring network adapter that's 32-bit, and they're constrained to that. So an interesting experience, but that truly could have been life or death based on compatibility. Those are the kind of things you look at before it. That's gold. Full regression test on those. Silver typically means bring someone in. And I have seen a lot of people say it's not just having them test it. If it's important enough for me to market silver, I want them in the room with me. Because I want to make sure they don't go, oh yeah, I tested it. Because that happens, right? When you send someone who runs a business unit, here's a list of 100 applications to test, and by the end of the day, you get a reply, everything's fine. You can be reasonably certain they didn't actually test them all. So silver often means get me in the room. They don't have to regression test them, but just make sure that they're kind of looking at some of the most important scenarios. Bronze will often mean maybe someone can test it, they can do it remotely. In some cases, I've even seen people say the IT team will do the testing, we'll do a quick validation, we'll make sure it's okay, but we're not going to spend a lot. Again, to ensure that we're putting the majority of our money in risk management in where the majority of the risk lives. And that's the goal. So this recategorizing and thinking about how to behave, it's all about quantifying your risk and figuring out how to act. One of the things that we do on top of this for our lower tiers within Microsoft IT, again, our agility needs are very different from most of the world's, is an approach that I refer to as canary in a coal mine, which is a horribly cruel thing that we used to actually do in the US for coal mines, is we had to determine if there was oxygen. There were no oxygen sensors in the day. So we said, all right, well, let's put a bird down there and let it sit there for a while and then pull it back up. If we pull it back up and the bird is dead, there's probably no air in that mine. If we pull it back up and the bird is alive, there's probably air. Send people down there. A very similar approach that we use is we say, all right, we're going to group these applications together by similarity, and we're going to test just a small percentage of them, and if some of them fail, we'll test more, because there appears to be something about this category of application that's more at risk. And if none of them fail, then we won't test anymore, and the rest we'll ignore. Obviously, the lower priority ones coming on the end of that, based on similarities such as platform, they're all Silverlight or VB6 or VB.net or whatever the case may be, solving this kind of problem built on top of SAP or whatever it is we built it on top of. But making sure we understand and access that. And I'll take, from Microsoft's perspective, I don't think we do as good of a job as we need to be, and I am a passionate advocate for this, of telling you what the approximate risk is. Because that doesn't sound very nice in marketing communications. You look, and you can probably still find it on the web, the original Windows Vista application compatibility cookbook that said, with a straight face, most applications continue to work. How many of you found that to be true? How many of you found that roughly 21.4% of your applications did not fall into the it just works category? Because that's the statistical mean that we actually found. But we don't like to report on that. Oh, by the way, it started off even higher. It started off about 30%. And it gradually crawled its way down, not because of changes to the OS, but rather because people bought new stuff. New stuff tended to work, so you were okay. So even though Windows Vista didn't itself see a ton of deployments, Windows Vista paved the way for successful Windows 7 deployments because the number one killer of applications was running them as a standard user, which is what UAC did for you. But that's what killed applications. UAC was actually a suite of technologies to fix them, not to break them. But we didn't fix all of them. There was still quite a bit of work to be done. The other finding we have when it comes to management is that management all up has gotten really, really complicated. And the way that people manage their applications, oh, I have no network connectivity. That's awesome. Okay, turns out I can fix that. Let me browse this. But in the interim, I can talk through the challenge, which is we have applications and configurations. And it seems as if there's this general feeling, particularly amongst the security community, that they probably get paid by the tweak. The number of changes I make in group policy directly correlates with how much money I ought to make. Have you met people like that? Where I go through every time a new platform comes out, I get the Excel spreadsheet printout of all of the group policies that are now available. And I'm going to go through them one by one and pick the best choice. And that'll be the group policies that I send out to an entire environment of 50,000 seats. Does anyone do things like that? We have a highly, highly customized environment, or does everyone just take the defaults that Microsoft ships? Defaults? No, or the highly customized. It's really common. And it's really common because the defaults often weren't secure enough for what people needed. So a friend of mine, Aaron Margosis, wrote a blog on this, which I think is the most important blog that's been written on how to reduce risk in an organization. And oddly enough, it's one of his least read blog posts ever, because he's one of those people like me. Like, this talk is an outlier talk for me. There's no debugger on the screen. That's an outlier for me. This has no code, no grungy stuff in it. It's an outlier for him, yet I think it's his most important one. Because this is the source of the vast majority of challenges we have. Security configurations. He did a great talk a while ago called the Unintended Consequences of Security Lockdowns. And I can tell you a story of one of them. So this, where it comes from is what's called the USGCB tech blog. USGCB stands for the United States Government Configuration Baseline. It's a standard configuration that is to be applied to every federal government agency in the entire country of the United States. All of them, mandated by the White House. Everyone has to have this configuration. If you feel you need an exception, you have to apply for one. Everyone is the same. And even in building this configuration, we were able to leverage the learning. As one example, there's a group policy that allows you to control to who gets the debug privilege. The debug privilege is not necessary for debugging applications, unlike the name makes it sound it, but instead it says I can get into any other process I want to on the operating system without an access check. That's what the debug privilege actually does, which is useful for debugging processes that other people own. There are potentially other uses for it, but that's really kind of the primary intent of why we built the privilege. And they said, I can't imagine anybody ever needing that. So they removed everybody from having that privilege. Nobody had it. And you think, well, great. Well, now no one can go poking around in other people's processes. That's a good thing, isn't it? And here's the unintended consequence. At the time that this happened, in about 2008, every single last piece of commercial database software, SQL Server, Oracle, DB2, MySQL, and there were a couple more at the time, none of them would install because they all took the debug privilege as part of their installation routines. So literally, the government of my country couldn't install new database instances for about 3 months until they found this and fixed it. And you wouldn't pick that up from your Excel sheet. When we look at the data that we get from our support organization, about 10% of all of the calls for support on Internet Explorer are a result of their configuration of Internet Explorer and not the way we ship it. Doesn't reproduce on a vanilla install of that browser. It's only in how they configured it. And, you know, I've got a... an illustration of that, so just why that is so complex and why that's so hard. And I'll kind of let this play in the background. It takes a little bit of time, so I'm not going to make everyone sit through that. Right? But how many different permutations are there? We think policy by policy, that's no problem. But we don't really think about what the manifestation of that is. Well, this is the actual number of different permutations that I have available to me. So if I sit there and tweak every single settings, I'm going to get one of these, and I have no idea which one I'm going to get. And it turns out there's kind of a lot of them. And this is where these configurations go wrong, is that even though I may think that I know what's going to happen based on that policy when combined with something else, strange things happen. And there's a lot of different combinations. And it turns out we don't have that many test cases, because here is the number of molecules in the observable universe by way of comparison. Doesn't even fill the first screen. We don't have as many test cases as it would take. So having a complete unknown starting point is really dangerous. So as a recommendation to address this, if you are looking for a way to start with a secure setting, number one, if the secure settings you're starting from are ones that you've been moving forward since IE6, every time I've seen an IE6 locked down configuration, it has always been less secure than the default configuration of today's versions of IE. Always less secure. So refresh, restart. And if you're going to refresh and are targeting high security, we have a tool called the Security Compliance Manager, which gives you recommended configurations that are known, proven, industry standard, and lots of people take them, so you don't have to be figuring out which of those permutations you're ending up in. Sticking with known solutions reduces your risk every time. So let's talk about assessment, right? So I found the stuff that I care about. I'm going to try and be a little bit smarter about how I manage it, about how I configure my organization. Now I have a change coming up, and I'd like to know what's going to break. As I said before, I don't think we do a really good job of telling you how much stuff is going to break. I'm going to try and fix that, because I think it's important. You can't make a good decision. In the interim, all you can do is measure how much of your stuff is breaking. Trust but verify, right? See if we got it right. So even if we do start to tell you, you should still go and check it out and make sure that it actually applies to your stuff. Because as a phrase that I picked up, I wish I knew who to attribute it to. I love it. I think it's Mark Twain. There are lies, damn lies, and statistics in that order. There are always outliers, right? So when I said, hey, Windows XP, you know, we see the actual statistical average of 21.4% of failure rate going through that. There are a lot of people for whom it's a lot lower. I had one customer for whom it was 100%. Everything broke. Because they deployed everything through MSI, and they had a custom action that was part of their corporate standard, and that custom action was not compatible, so nothing would install. They took the custom action out. We actually wrote some automation PowerShell to suck the custom action out of every single MSI, and then they went right back to what they should have, 20-something percent, and then it was back game on. But at 100%, you think that scared their management a little bit? It was a little terrifying. So how do we assess? So we'll give you some information, but we also want to understand what to look at. And in understanding what to look at, there's been a lot of hunts for silver bullets. Give me the software that will tell me how much of my stuff is broken, where it's broken, and how to fix it. Just give me the list, and I'll go fix it. And the problem is that everything is probabilistic, and the accuracy of the tool has to be translated into what happens per individual application. This is Bayes' algorithm for posterior probability predictions that tells us, with accuracy of a given rate, what do I expect the prediction quality to be for a single application? Could anyone apply this for me, please? I'm teasing. But if we use this algorithm, right, this is what we do with the statistics. AppCompat is a statistical matter. It really is, right? And we get this problem all the time. When we looked at what we saw in our ability to measure between Windows XP and Windows 8, or even Windows 7, we saw about an 85% accuracy rate from a line of tools that we call static analysis tools. They did pretty darn well. And it used to be even higher. They got worse over time, not because the tools got worse, but because the problem got harder. Fewer things break means it's harder to find things. It's a, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack is harder than looking for a needle in a needle stack, as you might imagine. But this translates to an individual accuracy prediction rate of 59%, because I only expect 21.4% of applications to break. Therefore, 85% accuracy has to be applied to my anticipated failure rate to determine what it's going to be like on a per-app level. It's still pretty good. It's way better than chance. But people don't expect to be wrong 41% of the time. If you expect to be wrong at that rate, then you can plan accordingly. It's still going to save you a ton of time, almost always. But if your process assumes perfection, you'll be sad. If your process assumes that it lives in the real statistical world, then your process can take these tools and go to town and save a lot of money. The problem is a lot of people look for the process to have 100% accuracy and then get sad when it doesn't. So when we looked at the rate when I go from Windows 7 to Windows 8, it went down a little bit because a lot fewer apps broke. And that lower failure rate meant that the somewhat diminished accuracy of the tools applied to a low failure rate meant that I was only right 12% of the time. Or, to invert it, I would be wrong 88% of the time. That may not meet my expectations. Now I've got to wonder how much that's going to help me unless I put it in exactly the right spot in my process. Well, what about moving my browser? Well, the browser accuracy moving from IE6, a really gnarly old one, although right now we still have 20-some-odd percent market share. I don't know, do you guys track that? Does anyone still have IE6? No one to make fun of, huh? That's awesome. We're still counting it down. On the IE6countdown.com, which now has a redirect, and we can see sort of our one hot spot left. China's at 11.1%, so fortunately China has a very small population, so that's not a whole lot of people. My accuracy moving off of 6 was about 30%, and that ended up being a posterior probability of 13%, so I was wrong quite a bit in the IE transition, but here's the transition everyone's looking at now. IE8 to IE11, the accuracy of the tools still is hovering about 30%. And that's not because people don't know how to write tools. We've invested a lot of money. We invested in partners. We collaborate with them. We give them all the resources they need. It's a legitimately hard problem. If something moves one pixel to the left, is that broken? Well, if it's just a form on the page, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who doesn't have a very severe case of OCD who would even notice. If, however, it's a construction drawing, and this moves one pixel, one pixel, one pixel, until all of a sudden, now I'm building the wrong thing, or the button slowly transitions over, and it's deeply, deeply nested, and suddenly it's behind a picture, and I can't click on it anymore, then that is broken. So what if it ends up breaking 10% of the time? Do we call it red? Do we call it yellow? What do we call it? It's different, but different doesn't mean broken, and determining broken is not something that we can always automate. And so we end up with an actual accuracy at the per application level of 2%. So we're wrong literally 98% of the time. I'm guessing that doesn't help you do much. And this constant quest for silver bullets. So when we talk about IE8, how many of you are familiar with enterprise mode? Okay, I'm hoping so, because there's an enterprise mode talk my buddy Fred is giving right now that you're missing to be here. So it's worth a look. I talked about it this morning in my web app compat talk. The goal of enterprise mode is to make fixing so darn easy that you can have a process that says, try it natively. If it doesn't work, enterprise mode. If it doesn't work, enterprise mode, and then throw in compat view if it didn't already have it, or turn it off if it did. And if those three don't work, escalate. And what you'll probably have is a very small pile, if anything, at the end that I've never seen exceed single digits. And suddenly, I don't need to have tools blasting through them because my process makes it easy for me to much more reliably see that it's working. As I mentioned, the challenge is that we need to define what's broken, right? Because we have this baseline notion of it has no bugs. And unfortunately, because of this guy's 1935, I believe, proof, it was in the 30s, or 36 maybe. This is Alan Turing, and he actually wrote the proof that determined that you is literally impossible, mathematically not feasible for us to determine that something has no bugs. And an incompatible application is just a special case of a bug where the bugs happen to appear on the platform that you care about and not the other one. It's still a bug. But what usually happens is the previous version let you get away with something and increased tightening of security or other configurations led to it to be a bug. But it has no bugs in the platform you want that stop you from working. We can't prove it has no bugs. Remember, Alan Turing made that mathematical statement very, very clear. So we have to focus on getting to the platform I want. It's So even when I'm using tools, even when I'm using processes, UAT is so, so important, particularly for my gold-managed applications. I have to have a user telling me I can actually do my job with this. So this whole process, right, of understanding how do I bring things together and get it in the hands of users, but also understanding that users aren't part of my team. They are not incentivized to be here, so I can't put too much burden on them. I want to make sure that my users are not abused. I'd like to have at least looked at some of the things before I put them in front of it, so they don't have an obvious crash. Hey, it doesn't even install. Why'd you call me here? You couldn't even do that before I get here. Understanding that process and how we do there. So when we look at some of the things that people are doing, we see people leveraging tools. And I will say this, some of the tools are really good, but you've got to understand the math. AppCompat is always a statistical exercise. We see people looking at ways to do industrialized batch processing, you know, for things like application packaging, for things like doing a quick install and launch. That was a really, really successful approach a lot of people used for Windows XP retirement projects because you could detect so many things on first launch that it was really predictive of whether the app as a whole would run. It wasn't perfect, still did UAT, but it was very predictive. And the other trend that we're seeing, and enterprise mode plays into this, is the notion of crowdsourcing, finding ways for more people to start piloting. I've seen organizations, one was a financial services institution, where they had department technical coordinators, is what they called them. And they would all get the newest, like they pried them with hardware, right? They would all get the newest hardware, and in exchange, they would test all their stuff before the rest of their people got it. And they would report back any problems. And so they became partners in the business, and they just got better hardware a little bit sooner. And some of the additional prestige, because there was a bit of prestige, it was a young organization, right? That works also, where you can ply them with hardware, which is unrelated anecdotal side note, but I've seen this concept of, you know, putting a little bit of prestige come into play. I had one of my customers, which was a different financial services institution, ply all of their end users to come and work there because if you worked there, you would get a MacBook Air. Now, of course, they didn't have any software written for the Mac operating system, so instead they had to run them with Windows, which they support through boot camp. But because they weren't using a modern version of Windows, they were using Windows XP, and their Windows XP wasn't so good at booting really quickly because of everything they put on there. So you'd have these beautiful MacBook Airs, you'd hand them to the user, oh, this is great, they'd open up, and they'd hit the on button, and 5 minutes later, I wish I were exaggerating, the thing would turn on. It would all be booted up and ready to go. 5 minutes. I don't recommend 5-minute boot times, but I do recommend crowdsourcing, and I do recommend bribing people with hardware if that's what works for the organization. The reason why crowdsourcing ends up being so important is because the complexity of organizations has gotten so intense. So this is a slide I borrowed or stole. It's public domain, but it fits into a talk given by a researcher from MIT named Cesar Hidalgo. And what he talks about is the network that exists in any society or organization. And you can measure the sophistication and the complexity of an organization by how many nodes you have to traverse in order to find out the truth. In summary, it means that in our hyper-complex organizations today, there is no one person that is capable of knowing how to do everything in the organization. So if your plan is, we're going to just get all the apps and we'll test them all. We'll just find out everything about them. Once you surpass a certain degree of complexity, it becomes not feasible. For example, how many of you know how to build a computer from scratch? And by from scratch, I mean you know how to go and mine the metal and then smelt it and then pound it into the wires and chips you need, right? And then create the presses that create the, I mean, no one person can do this. No one organization can do it. We rely on this network of all these different groups to come together to build this. And we wouldn't want it any other way because that measures our ability to do things. The success and the finances. You can map how complicated the network is to how much of a cost of living that society has. So it's a good thing. And if we embrace that that's a good thing, then we're much more successful. When we embrace that these are humans who are not part of our team, when we deal with UAT and mining through things, then we're more successful. As we start to measure and manage change, as we start to track across different groups who's ready to go, particularly in situations where we're able to target and deploy to specific machines and don't have to do forklift. So the forklift migration, which is I need to go and drop a new machine off, that still requires a lot more logistics. I hit them piece by piece. When I think about I'm going to lay out a new OS, push through System Center, or I'm going to push out a new version of the browser, I can just target it group by group and go and just start tracking this dashboard and manage my agility that way, and very successfully start to use peer pressure. Oh, Joe, the sales lead guy, what's wrong with your department? Why aren't they doing their stuff? This stuff actually plays out nicely in the CIO boardroom. People get embarrassed when their group is the one that's got the reds. Play to that embarrassment. I know I'm kind of teaching you to be devious and political, which is counter to everything that I believe in. The problem is it works. I've talked a lot about the technical aspect of compatibility. Here's the ugly truth. It's not all technical. The fact that it works doesn't mean the vendor will stand behind the fact that it works. Because they have a financial incentive to not support older versions of their stuff. Because they would like you to pay them for the new version of their stuff. And that's not surprising. And I'm guessing you'd kind of rather not pay them unless the new version of their stuff does something more than just support the new version of your platform. You'd like to have more business value than that. But as a for-profit entity, as most of these places are, they'll take whatever excuse they can get to get an upgrade. And so there's a conflict of financial interest, and those are always difficult to navigate. This, I don't have a solution for. We see this big time with enterprise mode, which is the concept of now if it works on 8, we can keep it working, and the statistics on that are staggering. We have yet to see a customer who would come back to us and say, oh, it works in 8, it doesn't work in enterprise mode, and the number that fall into that bin is greater than 5. I've never seen it. I had one customer tell me it's in the dozens, 3, 4 dozen. It's somewhere in the 30s to 40s. It's a big number, so I think you're lying to me. So I scheduled a visit, got on a plane, and went out to visit them, and here's what I found. Of the applications that were failing, they did indeed have dozens of them. 3 of them were triggered by Office. There was apparently a bug in Office where it was feeding a mangled URL to Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer was like, I don't know what to do with this URL. I'm going to give you a page cannot be displayed error. If I gave it a good URL, it navigated there just fine. So IE wasn't broken. In most of the rest, their IE migration also happened to include a Java update. And Java 7 Update 51 severely enhanced the security around whether their applets were digitally signed. All of their applets were either not signed or were digitally self-signed, so an untrusted certificate, and Update 51 caused them all to throw all kinds of exceptions and say, hey, add me to a policy in order to get me to work at all. Nothing to do with IE, it just happened to be resting inside of IE, and of course, if it's resting inside of IE, it must be our fault. And they had one application that was actually broken. And it was broken in such a fascinating way, I had to blog about it. Because how it was broken is, it was an application that was using VBScript. And I told, is anyone in my talk this morning, am I repeating it or is this new? Oh, wow, okay, it was a fun talk this morning. Here's what the application did, which blew me away. I actually called up one of the guys from the engineering team who couldn't believe it, he was beside himself. The application was running VBScript, and VBScript doesn't run in edge mode. IE11 stops running VBScript, but your previous docket modes, right, because we have 7 of them in IE11. There's 7 different ways we can behave, and it's only if you get the latest one that it doesn't work. And the solution's really easy, dial it back, and enterprise mode's a really easy way to dial it back. So it's, it's VBScript, we'll just put it in enterprise mode, that'll fix it. And put it in enterprise mode, it didn't fix it. I'm like, that's really strange. why would that not be fixing it? So I sort of dug into the page. I'm like, oh, so this is a web page that's hosting an ActiveX control, that's hosting the web browser control, that's hosting the page. That's completely bizarre. But OK, the web browser control should be defaulting to IE7 compatibility, which also runs VBScript. Except they added Mark of the Web to their web page to trigger it to go in internet zone to then get edge mode. So then I slapped my head and said, all right, well, I can go and delete the Mark of the Web, except the page wasn't pulling it from the website, which would be the obvious thing for a web page to do. Instead, it had embedded the HTML inside of a DLL that it installed as part of the ActiveX install. And every single time you navigated to that page, it would re-extract it, put it onto the file system, and then navigate and render that page. So in order to fix it, I had to literally resource hack the DLL to modify on the DLL's resources section the HTML that they were trying to spray down. And that's the one thing we didn't fix. And here's the thing. If you have an application architecture that's that crazy, I can't promise to fix you. Please don't make anything that crazy. Support is the problem. Functioning is easy. So how do we deal with support? And the final question is, once I get there, how do I start really taking advantage of it? And this is a really difficult conversation. We have people who say, listen, it's better, it's faster, it's more, you know, it works better with fingers and touch and new scenarios. How do I tie that to money? That can be difficult. I love this quote, right? If you want to be really, really conservative and say, if I can't quantify it directly, then just don't quantify it at all, then you prefer being precisely wrong than you do to being vaguely right. I love that quote. But let's talk about some of the ways to update. I think the first thing to do to update is to figure out what technical debt you've taken on. What did you choose not to do yet last time? This is sort of the big problem, is I choose not to do something, and then later on I forget that I chose to kick that can down the road a little bit, and now I'm surprised to find it. You know, I had one customer where their CIO, right, it was a big customer, so they're good friends with, you know, our chief operating officer. If you have a chief operating officer at a company like Microsoft getting yelled at for app compat, if you happen to be foolish enough to choose appcompatguy@microsoft.com as your email alias, suddenly you get angry emails in your inbox. Please go fix this. And he was told, if it works on Windows 7, it'll work on Windows 8. He's like, and that's not true. There are tons and tons of applications where that's not true. And I'm like, that's a little surprising. And it turns out, they had taken technical debt. They forgot to tell their management that. They said, oh, 64-bit, that seems a little bit hard for a Windows 7 migration. Let's just not do it yet. We'll just take 32-bit Win 7. And oh, UAC and standard user stuff, that's just a little bit hard. Yeah, you know what? Let's kick that can. Let's just turn that off. So the problem wasn't, hey, I have this thing that doesn't work. It was, oh, all the things that we expected you to do in the transition to Win 7, you decided to put off to later, which is OK, as long as you don't forget that later should eventually come. Otherwise, you're going to be hindered. Because right now, having UAC turned off is one example of a big problem. Because with UAC turned off, no modern apps in Windows 8 as one big risk. And you can say, oh, well, I don't need those anyway. OK. Another big risk is that we do literally zero testing with UAC turned off. We have no idea what happens, and weird stuff happens. As one example, turn UAC off and try, I think it's a JavaScript command to open a new tab, and you'll end up opening a new window, which may or may not matter. It's kind of a weird bug, but it really mattered to this customer. It was closed as, you're in an unsupported configuration. We don't care. Won't fix, is what we call it. Pay back your technical debt. Another one we're seeing in the IE world, this concept of session sharing, which is one of those weird bugs that either you have and it absolutely flattens you, or you don't have it at all. So in IE, the way that it used to work, if you have a non-persistent cookie or a session cookie, then that cookie would be shared within the process. But in IE6, that process was really just whatever window you open, double-click on the desktop, you'll get a new process and a new bag of cookies. In IE8 and later, we re-architected the browser with tabs such that We have a collection of individual processes for each tab. We share them smartly, so we balance between reliability and performance. And so in order to make it more predictable, rather than having every other tab share cookies or not, and you can't visually tell the difference, we actually have the parent process own the cookie bag, and they all share from amongst that. And therefore, in order to get around that, if you depend on being able to have separate logins and you don't want to use the manual workaround of file new session, you have to do all kinds of contortions around turning off no-frame merging and disabling all of your tabs and all these other really strange things. And that's one that you want to pay back. So there is quite a bit of technical debt that's out there. The other thing to consider is, do you have anything that's particularly brittle that you want to move away from? And this is one thing I haven't seen a lot of people start to track yet. Do you have an app that every single time you change something causes you grief? If so, figure out a way to invest to make the grief go away, because the cost of that one-time upgrade to fix it may be high until you start adding together all of the things that you've had to do just to keep that thing running. A measure of brittleness, I think, is helpful. Understanding where your pain is being caused. As an example, I see a lot of applications that have a dependency on older versions of Java. I'm guessing you may have heard of this. Right? Where, I only work on Java 1.5 update 12, and I love how they won't even let you patch it. Gotta have this one. No patches, no none for me. So Java, that might be a little dangerous. So if you look at the exploit kits that are out there, you can go out and download a kit that will make you free exploits. What do the exploit kits target? Well, they used to target, we'd look for vulnerabilities in Adobe Reader and Java at first, then we introduced some Windows and some Flash vulnerabilities. They look for what's out there and what works. And what we see in terms of actual statistics, these are what people are being successful with. The blue is Java. Does that mean the people who write Java don't know how to write programs? No, they're a victim of the app writers who are forcing the hand of the enterprise. The app writers say, oh, I only want this version of Java because I can't be sure I'll run otherwise. And rather than, checking and enforcing before I go, I'll check every single time anyone launches me on any desktop ever, which is a very strange approach. And as a result, the bad guys have figured out, pretty much every enterprise in the known universe locks in on a particular version of Java, so I just wait for the next round of Java updates to come out, I reverse engineer where the bad things is, or I just get lazy and wait for it to show up in the exploit kit, and then use that one, and then successfully attack all kinds of enterprise machines. All kinds of them. That's brittleness. So when you start to identify, well, which are my apps that are actually keeping me tied to those versions of Java, which is actively putting me in harm's way, those are the kinds of things I want to seek and destroy. Get rid of brittleness. And in general, Java or anything else, don't check for version numbers. Ever. There's never a good reason to check for a version number. It doesn't help you. The total cost, and I did some preliminary math, and I got to publish it one of these days, but I estimate that the cost to human society of version number checking is in excess of at least $2 billion. The total cost that I can directly quantify and name, and there's probably a lot more beyond that. The total benefit, I'm not sure we'd even measure in the tens of dollars. So how is that helping anybody? The one industry in which it makes sense is the industry where I have healthcare that has regulatory requirements, right? We see it a little bit in financial services as well, where I'm by law required to. So I don't have a choice. But in terms of my choosing to, this is just someone being lazy and saying, you know what, I don't care. Throw it on the $2 billion pile. Not a big deal, because I don't have to pay it. It's what's called an externality. Right? And when we think about externality and cost and paying, this is sort of the way that I phrase it when talking to the product team. So this is kind of the graph that I draw. I usually put labels on it, but I don't like a lot of verbose slide decks, as you may have noticed. But this shows where I think we need to put our focus on. Here's what this graph is showing you. The blue is the cost that I invest in testing. The green is the cost that I invest in remediation. And this is specifically to IE. Migrating off of IE6 for most people was pretty expensive. And we kept getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and enterprise mode made it cheaper still. So fantastic. We took that remediation cost and brought it way down. That's awesome. The cost of testing, you'll note, has stayed the same. People are still just as scared. They don't realize, hey, this is going to be easier than the old one was. And so they invest just as much doing that transition, which means we've got to do better at helping you test. So crowdsourcing in Internet Explorer's enterprise mode is part of that. We also need to do better in communicating the numbers so you know how much you should invest to manage your risk. The other story I tell is that you should be able to depend on a bit of what I call punctuated equilibrium. Right? So if you look at the three lines here, the blue line is constant innovation. This is all of the cloud services are looking to do. I'm Salesforce.com. I am aggressively competing with lots of people. I've got SAP breathing down my throat. Maybe Microsoft. I'm actually not a CRM expert, so I don't know where the real hot and heavy competition is. But I need to differentiate by having an amazing experience on my application, which I can now do in the web. I can now do as an app. I can now do this. So constantly give me new good stuff, and I am investing. I have hundreds of developers behind it. Typical on-premise in my data center application, I don't want to touch more than once every 6 years. And the 6 years is people being generous. What they do today is it's about 12. They said you could maybe push us to 6, but below 6, it doesn't work for me. That's what enterprise mode is designed to accommodate, is this philosophy. Punctuate equilibrium. Keep it working for a while. We are deliberately not designing for the red line, which is let me make it once and never change it again forever. We're not designing for that. But we are trying to design for, let me keep it around for a reasonable amount of time and don't break it. And in doing that, by letting you stop focusing on constantly changing everything to keep up to date, I think what's important from a migration standpoint is if you followed the line, got your migration done, and you're at the point where X marks the spot, it's time to dig for treasure. We're following the treasure map. We're getting to Windows 8 or Windows 10 or IE 11. And if we don't make anything good, we've just walked on the dotted line. We didn't get anything out of it. And that's really important to me. And I'll suggest it's gotten even more important. When I look at the curve of innovation in terms of where it lives, think back, and I'm an old guy, you can tell. I look old. But I remember back in the days when if you could just keep up, think of the features you would get. Old versions of Windows, you would get, hey, there's a TCP/IP stack now. You don't have to write your own anymore. I mean, this is where we came from. You're like, well, just keep up. And I would just get networking. And I didn't have that. And then for a while, it inverted. And all of the innovation came in the apps because the platform just did enough for what computers were at the time, the form factors that existed. And so the innovation went into the apps, and all these money went into the apps, and you could tell the difference. You went from lots of small, very agile applications to these massive, what I call the application Taj Mahals. Let's just build it bigger, 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 to the point where you have SAP projects as an example where it's not unusual to see a 7-year implementation project. I saw that one, 7 years, and they were late. Because bigger, 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 because the platform does what it wants. But think about what the platform is doing for you now. Now it's like, oh, I'd like to support these touch devices. Oh, I get that for free. I'd like to do animation, but I'm terrible at animation, and I'm terrible at using Flash. I can get that for free. I'd like to have it automatically, dynamically scale to the size of the screen so I can build one web page, have it work on a tiny little phone and a giant widescreen monitor. And I can do that for free if I get caught up. The innovation is coming in the platform again. We're stuck with all those app Taj Mahals. So I refer to that as the appification, building lots more smaller things that solve the problem. If you look at some of the demos that we build together, we are not sacrificing the things that have been built and starting over. We're building something small. When we released Windows 8, there's a demo from Emirates Airlines, which is the experience that we give to flight attendants, because they want everything to look great, right? This is a customer service company, and they want to make sure that things look great, and they do. But behind that little Windows 8 application isn't everything it needs to do. It calls a loopback to a desktop app that's running, hiding behind the scenes, giving additional value to all of that code that they've written over the years, just looping back and saying, desktop app, can you do some extra work for me here because I don't know how to do anything? And the desktop app finishes the job. They just built a small part, right? And now this little app is able to be agile and jump and take advantage of all kinds of new stuff. This complete change, that update, and moving forward is really important, right? To make it faster, to remove your dependency, right? This is a big thing, particularly with HTML5, because people I've heard are sick and tired of having to have fights where they call the Flash guys and they say, oh, it's an IE bug. And then they call the IE guys and they say, oh, no, that's a Flash bug. And Adobe Reader gets plugged in. Oh, that must be the other guy's bug. All the finger pointing, right? No cooperation. Investing in getting new experiences, making things cheaper, measuring where you have brittleness, getting them easier to maintain, easier to get data, and driving business value. And here's an interesting business value conversation I'll give you as a free one. I'm just checking my time. I got about 5 minutes, so we can do this. When I talk business value doesn't have to be all high and cloudy. I get nerdy on business value conversations, too. It might be because I'm a nerd. I'm guessing. But this conversation actually won them over. HTML5 is terse. So here's a typical HTML4 web page. Let's start dissecting this and breaking this down into what it would look like if I just used the basics. There's nothing, it's a hello world page. There's nothing sophisticated to here. But HTML5 takes that ridiculous doc type and says, yep, it's HTML. Okay, so then it takes that HTML with the XML namespace, because it's clearly XHTML, and says, it's HTML and it's in English. We say, okay, well, you've got that whole content type thing. That's awfully long. HTML5, it's UTF-8. And, that style sheet, that's kind of long also. Let's shorten that as well. And we end up with a much more terse page. And it's not that it's more beautiful and easier to maintain, although it is. It's that it's 412 characters versus 188 characters. And if we get our friendly calculator back up again, 412 minus 188 is 224. 224 characters that I save with every single request. So let's say that I have a web application that gets 1,900, I don't know, let's do it simple, 100 requests per minute. And so 60 minutes in an hour and 8 hours in a day, it's only used during business hours. So I end up saving that many bytes over the course of a day. And I'm going to work 5-day weeks, and I'm going to work for, 48 weeks of the year. And I end up with that many bytes that I save over the course of the year, or that many gigabytes, megabytes, that many gigabytes. So that many terabytes. If you're the person paying the bandwidth bill, and someone says, hey, if we go to HTML5, I can save you 2.4 terabytes of network traffic a year, we might have a conversation going. And it's boring and nerdy, right? A very similar conversation was a customer who was going to Windows 7 and paid for it because they took a little measurement right at the tap, right where the machine's plugged in. Plugged in one machine and ran it for the course of a week, plugged in a machine running Windows 7, ran it for the course of the week, and they measured how much electricity it sucked out of the wall. And the Windows 7 sucked out enough that they multiplied it by the number of machines. They saved enough money in electricity that they could pay for the whole deployment. It's boring and it's nerdy, but it's true. And that's interesting. So defining that ROI, understanding how to build it. So this whole concept, right, all we are about, really helping to figure out how we can provide you with the right tools, the right approach from a platform perspective to not break your stuff. We know that's important. We kind of figured that out. There are lots of things that we're really investing in hard now. I mean, look at Windows 10. Windows 10, it's like, yeah, we'll get to consumers later. Enterprise, yeah, you know what? You didn't see a whole lot of love on 8, but we're fixing that. right? And I think we've shown it. Enterprise Mode IE came out in April. Bang, now remediation costs go way down. The Site Discovery Toolkit came out literally this past month, documented last week. Bang, we care about you understanding what's going on. At this moment, down the hall, Fred Pullen is introducing a new tool for anyone who's already on 9 or 10 that extends Enterprise Mode to also apply to any other document mode that you want. I see some eyes going up. I missed that announcement. Well, I just told you about it. The blog is going up right now as we see. It may already be up. We can look for it when we're done. The amount of love in the enterprise, in the Windows team especially, but across the organization is massive, and it really, really matters. We want to help you get modern while being durable, and we are just getting started. Thank you very much.